debt. It keeps you tossing and turning at night. You can't get away from it. But the truth is, the system is designed to trap you in debt. Insanely high interest credit cards and loans make it nearly impossible to pay off your debt. There's a new way out of the debt trap, Pivotal Debt Solutions. Pivotal Debt Solutions isn't like the old school debt relief companies that string your debt out for years. They have aggressive strategies that can end your debt faster and easier than you thought possible. Pivotal Debt Solutions can cut or even eliminate interest. Find programs to write off your balances so you owe less. Stop those threatening phone calls, and without bankruptcy and without a loan. Bottom line, they find every solution possible to end your debt permanently. Before you do anything, contact Pivotal Debt Solutions first. Talk to them for free. Find out how fast they can help you get out of debt. Visit zapmydebt.com. That's zapmydebt.com. Zapmydebt.com.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to our program. On the line with us is our buddy, Professor Richard Wolff, the economist, the co-founder of democracyatwork.info, the author of numerous books, including his most recent, which is also available as an e-book, The Sickness is the System: When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or Itself, and the host of Economic Update with Professor Richard Wolff right here on Free Speech TV, democracyatwork.info, Prof. Wolff over on Twitter. And Professor Wolff, welcome back to the program. There's a couple of stats here. We saw this, you know, inflation has only slightly moderated a couple of days ago, which cratered the stock market. Now there's also the producer price index just came out, and it's actually declined 0.1%, which is wholesale. This is wholesale prices falling. And the headline PPI increased 8.7%, which is a substantial, this is year over year, a substantial pullback from the 9.8% increase. So it looks to me like, you know, inflation is starting to moderate, although the Fed is talking about, or people are speculating that the Fed is talking about a 1% increase in interest rates. And then there's this piece over at Bloomberg.com by Tracy Alloway. There's a new recession canary in the coal mine, according to Morgan Stanley. And this is these adjustable rate mortgages, which became a thing. Particularly after the housing crash in 2009, people started getting these, and now their interest rates are going to start going up as the Fed increases interest rates, and there's a concern that this might cause a whole new housing crisis. So what's up with inflation, and what do these numbers mean, and what are your thoughts on all this?
Well, I think I'm a little surprised by the Stiglitz article and so on, because it's a truism by now across the political spectrum that 1 month or even 2 months of statistics are too apt to need revision over time, which they usually get, and are too apt to be subject to all kinds of influences that you're not interested in because you want to see what the kind of longer trend, what's really going on. So it is very dangerous to respond to any particular month, including this last one. There's nothing about that rule that doesn't apply anymore at this time. I think what's going on is that more liberally inclined economists, for understandable reasons, are very worried about this program of the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates. That hurts poor people the most. It hurts them because they can't afford hardly anything anymore. And now you're going to make the borrowing, which is what they did to cope with the inflation, cost them more than before. I mean, they're going to be hurt by the inflation. Now they're going to be hurt more by what you're doing to so-called slow the inflation. And then their worst nightmare, you could raise interest rates and it could still not slow the inflation, just slow the economy down. And then you get the thing we call stagflation. And, you know, you've put the American working class through the second worst depression in the last 3 years we've ever had, through a terrible public health disaster, now an inflation, and you're about to unload rising interest rates. You've already done that. You know, at a certain point, you have to begin to wonder what kind of a system subjects the mass of its people to this kind of ongoing attack. That's the first thing. Mm-hmm. The second point, which is the other article you pointed out to, and that's a very important point. We have more levels of corporate debt, not so much personal debt, although that's at record highs, and government debt, which is off the chart. But we have enormous corporate debt. We've had interest rates so low that every corporation for the last 20 years that had any kind of economic problem, the quickest, easiest, and cheapest way to solve it, go borrow money, because the interest rates were literally approaching zero, unheard of in a peacetime situation, et cetera, et cetera. So they're all borrowed up to here. What people don't know is that the overwhelming majority of those loans are at variable rates. In other words, the interest rate these loans carry varies with the interest rates pretty much that the Federal Reserve sets. So if the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates, which they have been doing and which they will be doing later this month, again, the only question is how much, then it's making the burden of the debt already carried by these large borrowers even higher than it was before, which risks putting them in an impossible situation. The economy is not roaring ahead, to be polite. It is limping along. Their revenues are far from soaring. But meanwhile, with variable rates, their debt is going to go up, and dramatically. That is a terrible place for the bulk of our corporations to be at. And in that situation, raising interest rates could quickly plunge a lot of them into default. That would show up in the records of what we call the index of corporate loans. And so there's this idea, let's look at that, because it'll give us a foretaste of the recession and how bad it'll be. Notice all the commentary is about an economy afflicted by interest rate rises, afflicted by inflation, and continuing, as we've discussed before, to refuse to even allow the conversation to talk about wage price freezes, to talk about rationing, which are ways of dealing with these problems that do not immediately impact the mass of people in the harsh way that both inflation and rising interest rates do.
Or a tax on windfall profits,
which the British have done. The British have imposed a tax on the windfall profits of oil and gas companies. I mean, it's a little bizarre. I don't want to take a lot of your time, but the government is proposing to tax them. And then guess what? To use a large part of the money to give to individuals and businesses to help them pay the inflated prices. So that money will end up going right back to the corporations who were taxed in the first place. I mean, there are weird ways of solving problems, but there's a peculiar quality, the ones we have, that they tend to favor those at the top at the expense of all the rest of us, right, which your whole opus of work and writing over the years, Tom, has illustrated for us all, and we're seeing it in bold colors now.
Yeah, well, thank you, Professor Wolf. And it is so true. I mean, and largely this was brought to us by the Supreme Court that basically established oligarchy in the United States with a series of decisions, 76 Buckley, 78 1998, Bilotti, 2010, Citizens United, that legalized political bribery. I'm curious what your thoughts are on this $1.4 trillion of outstanding mortgage loans that are variable rate. This is twice the size of the variable rate market that it was in 2015, just 7 years ago. And, you know, this author over at Morgan Stanley, or this analyst at Morgan Stanley, is saying, you know, this is something that could really blow up in our faces all over again. It would be 2008 all over again. Do you think that there's a serious risk there? Or was that, did that, you know, melt down in 2008 because of the way that those loans were being repackaged and sold, you know, basically criminally by the banksters?
Well, it's two separate problems that are linked. On the one hand, the thing blew up because you had built this edifice, this house of cards, based on the mortgage loans. And it blew up when the underlying borrowers of those mortgages couldn't pay back. And then the insurance contracts written around all of that weren't sustainable. There wasn't enough money in the system to cover all of these bets that had gone bad because the underlying population couldn't carry the mortgage. She's quite right, the Bloomberg analyst. She's quite right. That could happen again. And we have done a lot of work about the linkage between mortgages on the one hand and all of the elaborate financial instruments built on top of them. But we could still have the mortgage failure, and it would have a whole new set of consequences. By themselves, I don't know if they're large enough to mess up the whole economy. But the rest of our economy is in terrible trouble. Mortgage debt from individuals who buy a home is one thing. Variable rates also affect all those corporations that have loans at variable rates. You put together a failure in the mortgage sector with a failure in the corporate loan sector, then you have a situation where the government, which would normally come in and try to save the situation, is already in record territory of having borrowed even more than the other two players in this game, the individual and the corporation. And you're talking about debts going crazy and the ability of the system to manage it being put in question. And the minute that happens, think about all of the countries, the corporations, the wealthy individuals who have put for safekeeping their money in the United States. If they begin to see this level of dysfunction, the crash, the poor performance in controlling COVID, which is how the world sees it, then the inflation, now the rising interest rates, and the risk of defaulting variable loans, at a certain point, you're going to cross a new tipping point. And it's a tipping point in which the United States is no longer the center of the global financial universe. And how players around the world react to that could be as big or bigger a factor in our future. We are skating on very thin ice, and the denial of it and the pretense that we're in the good old days where we can do what we once did with a reasonable hope it's going to work out, that's not there anymore. We may be able to solve our problems, but it does not help to pretend that they're not as profound as they clearly are.
Yeah, it sounds to me like this combination of consumer debt going up and corporate debt going up is really where it goes from being a firecracker to a small nuclear bomb going off.
And the whole rest of the world is watching how we react or fail to these problems.
Yeah, I get it. Professor Wolf, thank you so much. It's always enlightening speaking with you. I truly appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're welcome. DemocracyAtWork.info, Prof. Wolf over on Twitter. And the program on Free Speech TV, Economic Update with Professor Richard Wolf. Definitely worth checking out. Jeff in San Francisco, watching on Free Speech TV. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Well, climate change and political solutions we can do. You know, Germany, you've talked many times, has a solar bank, I believe.
They have an enormous amount of solar energy, and about probably, I don't know, between a fifth and a third of the homes in Germany have solar panels. But
I thought you spoke.
It was Jimmy Carter who talked about creating the nation's first solar bank.
Yeah.
That was in 1979.
Yeah, but they have a program there. I believe it's how you can prorate.
Oh, yeah, it was called 100,000 Rooftops. That was back 15 years ago? That was a long time ago.
Yeah, they're about 50% now.
Are they?
And
I haven't looked recently.
Yeah, I think they've had like many days in one summer worth it, and they're not very sunny. You live there. But where they had like 100% renewable.
Yes, they hit that for a couple of weeks last year.
Well, I bring this up yesterday. California's having terrible problems with PG&E, and they're fighting everybody getting solar on their roofs like crazy because it's such a corrupt situation.
Well, PG&E is a private for-profit corporation that has been convicted of multiple murders now.
Oh yeah, they're keep doing the same thing. The simple things like covering up, insulating those lines that are just bare wires in the forest and everywhere.
Well,
and
the solution isn't to insulate them; it's to bury them.
Yeah, but it's all about profit. And
yep.
It's a big scam.
Yeah, burying lines is very expensive.
Well, and then they're gonna charge us for it, you know. And then they want to, and then if we fight back with solar, they're gonna try to charge us for us getting solar.
Yep.
So I love Gavin Newsom, but he's a little bit in bed with them. And there's no such thing as a perfect politician. I realize.
So what's your point, Jeff?
Well, yesterday I talked to Loretta Lynch. She used to be president of the Public Utilities Commission in California, and I asked her about the combination of California. I go, what's stopping us from doing something like Germany with 100,000 solar rooftops? She said political will. So yeah. I just want to give a little shout out to other Californians out there. If we had a public bank like North Dakota's, we can do that. And we just take the political will of the people to, you know. And we had a little movement in San Francisco to get a public bank, but had a little bunch of banksters came in the middle of it, and they said, oh, you can't do that, you can't do that.
Oh, of course. But, you know, for people who don't know what we're talking about, Jeff, in North Dakota, the state runs a bank. It was chartered in, like, 1909 or 1913, largely for farmers who couldn't get credit from the commercial banks. And it has helped that state through thick and thin, through tough times and good. It is, it's like the lender of last resort in North Dakota. It's a big deal. It works really well. The people there love it. And frankly, in my opinion, every state should have their own state bank.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, I mean, who has the most money? The banks. They make the money.
Yep. Yeah, they literally do. I mean, this is how our money supply is.
They create a thin air.
That's right. Is regulated. Is through fractional reserve banking. Jeff, thank you for the call. Speaking the truth to the multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know all about. I'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
And welcome to Tom Hartman University Book Club. Today we're reading from The Crash of 2016. This is one of the very last chapters. It's titled Green Revolution. Just as America now faces an unsustainable thirst for energy, so too was Germany faced with a power crisis in the late 1990s. Growing demands for electricity collided with the reality that the country has no oil reserves and a strong bias among its people against building nuclear power plants in the wake of the nearby Chernobyl meltdown. Yet the government knew that the country needed the electricity, equivalent of at least one or two new nuclear power plants over the next decade. So how to generate that much electricity without nuclear power? In 1999, progressives in Germany passed the 100,000 roofs program, which mandated that banks had to provide low-interest 10-year loans to homeowners sufficient for them to put solar panels on their roofs. They then passed the Renewable Energy Law and integrated the 100,000 roofs program into it in 2004. The Renewable Energy Law, REL, mandated that for the next 10 years, the power company had to buy power back from those homeowners at a level substantially above the going rate so that the homeowners' income from the solar panels would equal their loan payments on the panels and would also represent the actual cost to the power company to generate that amount of power by building a new nuclear power plant. At the end of the 10 years, the power company gets to buy solar power at its regular rate, and it now has a new source of power without having to pay and maintain and eventually dismantle a nuclear reactor. In fact, while the reactor would have a 20 to 30-year lifespan, the solar panels typically last 50 years. For the homeowners, it was a no-brainer. They were getting low-interest loans from banks for the solar panels, and the power companies were paying for the power generated from those panels at a higher rate, high enough to pay off the loans. It was like getting solar power panels for free. If anything, the government underestimated how rapidly Germans would embrace the program, and thus how quickly power would be produced by the program. By 2007, Germany accounted for about half the entire world's solar market. Just that one year, 2007, saw 1,300 megawatts, and a megawatt is a million watts, 1,300 megawatts of solar generating capacity brought online just across Germany. For comparison, consider the average generating capacity of each of the last five nuclear power plants brought online in the United States. That capacity is 1,100 megawatts. So Germany had 1,300 megawatts just in 2007 added. In 2008, Germany added 2,000 megawatts of solar power to their grid, like two nukes. And in 2009, homeowners and businesses put onto their roofs enough solar panels to glean an additional 2,500 megawatts. Although the goal for the first decade of this century was to generate around 3,000 megawatts, eliminating the need to build two new nuclear power plants, the simple no-risk program had instead added over 8,000 megawatts of power, roughly eight nuclear power plants. And because the generation sources were scattered across the country, there was no need to run new high-tension power lines from central generating stations, making it more efficient and less expensive. Meanwhile, as dozens of German companies got into the business of manufacturing and installing solar power systems, the cost dropped by more than half between 1997 and 2007 and continues to plummet. The Germans expect that by 2050, more than a quarter of all their electricity will come from solar. It's now just over 1%. Now, I wrote this book 2.5 years ago. Germany this summer produced 100% of their electricity this way. That's how rapidly this has changed just in the last 3 years. It's really remarkable. Adding to the roughly 12.5% of all German energy currently produced by renewable sources, mostly hydro, but also wind, biomass, and geothermal. The solar panel program has been so successful that the German government is now thinking that it's time to back off and leave this to the marketplace, which they've largely done. And it's not just leaving it to the marketplace. They had to reinvent their grid. There's to be a smart grid to handle all the added electricity that all these solar panels were producing. They have too much electricity now in Germany. Germany is now considering incentives to its world-famous domestic auto industry to manufacture flex-fuel plug-in hybrid automobiles that can get over 500 miles per gallon of strategic gasoline, boosted by domestically produced rooftop solar with existing technology. Meanwhile, Denmark has invested billions in having more than half of its entire auto fleet using only electricity by 2030. And China is no slouch when it comes to renewable energy. Although the Chinese continue to bring another dirty coal-fired power plant online about once a week, they surpassed every other nation in the world in 2010 in direct investment in the production of solar and wind power. As the Los Angeles Times reported in March of 2010, U.S. clean energy investments hit $18 billion last year, a report from the Pew Charitable Trust said, a little more than half the Chinese total of $34 billion. 5 years ago, Chinese investments in clean energy totaled just $2.5 billion. The United States also slipped behind 10 other countries, including Canada and Mexico, in clean energy investments as a share of the national economy. The Pew report pointed to another factor constraining U.S. competitiveness, a lack of national mandates for renewable energy production or a surcharge on greenhouse gas emissions that would make fossil fuels more expensive. The ultimate power to the people is for homes to have their own solar roofs, no longer needing power lines from distant power plants owned by big transnational corporations. The crash of 2016.
Grayson in Redding, California. Hey, Grayson, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Hey, I was looking at the stats for HDI of states, the Human Development Indexes. This was back in 2020. And I was also comparing how the state governments were set up, like which ones had a Democratic trifecta, which ones had a GOP trifecta. And it was pretty interesting. So I was using the 25th ranking as the median percentile or in the middle. So in the top 10, six of those states are Democratic trifectas. Three in that top 10 spot are Democratic majorities. Only one is a GOP trifecta. Now let's look at the bottom.
Which state is that, by the way? Texas or Florida?
North Dakota, I think. North or South Dakota was the only GOP one that was in the top 10. Then at the bottom 10 spots, 8 out of 10 of those were GOP trifectas. Then also, too, 66% of Democratic trifectas were likely to be in the above the median percentile, and 80% of the GOP trifectas were below the median percentile.
So by median, you're talking median percentile of what? Are you measuring wealth?
Well, the HDI score.
And what does HDI stand for?
Human Development Index. It's a standard of living score.
Oh, this is the measurement of everything from infant mortality to lifespan to general health and those kinds of things, right?
Yeah, correct. So that's what I was looking at and how the states.
So in other words, the blue states are healthier, you live longer, you're happier than in red states. That's the bottom line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so yeah, I thought that was pretty interesting.
Well done, Grayson. Thank you very much for that.
I don't know how it's changed in the past 2 years. Probably not much, but...
No, I would be surprised if it. If anything, it's probably gotten worse. Grayson, thank you for that. I appreciate the call. Ziggy in Oneonta, New York. Hey, Ziggy, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, I want to let everyone know that the voting has started. I've received my absentee ballot, and I have voted. So I'm already done voting for the year. So I just want to call that to everyone's attention. Every state is different. But I know here in New York State, you only have a few more days to register or to apply for an absentee ballot. But I've already voted.
Okay, so get out there and vote. And Ziggy, how goes the, what is it, endbribes.com website?
Endbribes.com, and I got something new. I think you're going to like it, Tom. I find that many people are afraid to wear a shirt or put on a bumper sticker because they're concerned about a violent situation. Mm-hmm. And what I've come up with is what I call voting information cards. And they're basically little business cards that I carry around, and I just drop them off like Johnny Appleseed, all these different places I go with us, the grocery store, the doctors. And on one side, it'll have like what Democrats gave you and what the Republicans have taken from you, why original Medicare is better and Advantage is a scam. And so far, I've done six of them, and I just, you know, leave them in different places for people to find and read.
Wow, how cool. So I'm going to have to get over to your site at endbribes.com and order some of those for myself, Ziggy.
Yeah, you're going to have to. And also, I'll take any suggestions because I don't think mine are perfect, but they definitely could use improvement.
What is your best selling bumper sticker or T-shirt?
It's Democracy is the Solution.
That's great. That's a strong one.
That's a great one. Yeah, that's my best selling one. Yes.
Okay. Well, Ziggy, endbribes.com. Right. Hey, Thanks a lot, Ziggy. Good talking to you. Ed in Erie, Michigan. Hey, Ed, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, I'm going to dust us off of this subject, take the dust off it a little bit.
Okay.
I've been meaning to talk to you about it for a long time concerning the Gulf of Tonkin incident. And in 2003, Robert McNamara was in a documentary where he that was about his life, not just the Gulf of Tonkin, okay? But went through his whole life. You know, he was with Curtis LeMay in the planning of the bombing of the Japanese.
Right. Goddard LeMay was his name. Yep.
Yeah, Bombs Away LeMay, yeah. But anyway, but now he said that, and you hit on this quite some time ago. God, it might have been a year ago. I just want your opinion. Now, according to that documentary, there was two incidents in the Gulf of Tonkin. The first one was real, but LBJ didn't act on it. Now, this was McNamara talking. But the second one, and they got, like you got recordings of Roosevelt, they were playing recordings of these, I don't know if it was the ship captain or whatever, talking about this thing, and these guys were really unsure that this second incident actually happened. But that's the one that they started the war over. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and McNamara knew that it was a lie right from the beginning, and LBJ didn't know that until 2 weeks in. But at that point, he'd already committed to action.
Yeah, right. I think you had Katrina Van Hoogel. See, now, you didn't say that when you had Katrina Van Hoogel or Hoogel.
Van Hoogel. From The Nation.
Yeah, it was that long ago. It's been almost a year ago that you were talking about. It's the first chance I get to call on. But it's a great documentary. And if you haven't seen it, you should see it. You know, it's called The Fog of War, is what it's called.
And where'd you find it? Where did you find it? Where did you see it?
Oh, this was back in, it was on HBO or something. Okay. I got HBO and showed. Yeah, it was on that back in, he was still alive. In fact, he was still alive when it was, well, of course it was still alive. He was still, but when it was shown, I seen it like in 04 or 05.
Yeah.
You know, but I learned so much about, because this guy was in everything. He was like you. He was a very smart man. He was the first head of Ford Motor Company that wasn't a Ford when Kennedy reached out and grabbed him and got him to join his administration. And it's a heck of a documentary about his whole, like I said, this guy had his hand in everything.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I didn't realize that, you know, just how interesting that is, you know.
I think there are some parallels between Robert McNamara and who's the guy that George W. Bush had as his defense secretary who, you know, the known knowns and the unknown unknowns, you know, Don Rumsfeld, right. Yeah, who had been the president of the pharmaceutical company that got, as I recall, Tylenol approved, or was it aspartame? Maybe it was aspartame. But in any case, you know, they were both kind of Renaissance man types who had, you know, long careers in business as well as government. And then, you know, at the very end, it kind of looked like they were also maybe a little nuts.
which I suppose I qualify as,
but who knows?
Yeah, and at one point, the narrator asks him, well, how many, you know, when you left the administration, what was the death toll in Vietnam at that time? And it was in the high, it was 28, I think he said, which ended up being, what, we're almost at 59, I think. It's close to
59,000, yeah.
But when he left, and
well, and that was the, you know, the second half of the death toll was attributable to Nixon. In 68, LBJ had actually worked out a peace deal with the Vietnamese. And Nixon, you know, interfered in that election and by reaching out to the Vietnamese and saying, don't go along with the peace deal. And then you had another 20,000-30,000 Americans die, 20,000 plus Americans die between that time and the time that Jerry Ford finally ended the war. It wasn't Nixon who ended the war, it was Ford. Nixon just lied through his teeth that he had a secret plan. His secret plan was to pay off basically bribe the senior leadership of South Vietnam not to go along with LBJ. And then bomb the crap out of everybody. I mean, it was just nuts. And I got to move along, but thanks for the call and thanks for the memories. That's a good one. Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. With higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR, all into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. It's accessible from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. head to netsuite.com/Hartman with two N's. netsuite.com/Hartman. That's netsuite.com/Hartman.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Maverick in Edmonds, Washington. Hey, Maverick, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, I apologize for the noise again. I'm driving my truck, and by the way, for your reference, it's 88 decibels in here.
Whoa.
All made every day.
All good.
And real quick, you made the editorial section of my local newspaper twice in the last month. Once the Hartman Report was referenced, and another time it was your words in the editorial from our local readers up here just north of Seattle. Kind of cool.
Really? Really? Cool.
Yeah.
So this is like letters to the editor, you mean?
Calling is, yeah, my favorite part of the newspaper.
That's great.
Yeah.
Mine too.
Yeah. Reason I'm calling is I wanted to get your thoughts on minority rule versus majority rule. I consider myself, philosophically democratic. For example, you know, if I was with a group of seven people and I was part of the three that wanted to go left and the four wanted to go right, I would just go, okay, well, you know, four beats three, we'll follow them. And I would do it without any complaints. But, you know, when you apply that to a country of 330-whatever million people, you know, something bothers me about 100 million people not getting what they need or not getting what they want. Where's the, in your opinion, where's the justice, where's the balance, where's the artful solution to that? You know what I'm saying? Am I explaining myself?
No, I think, you know, I believe in the wisdom of crowds. I believe in democracy. And, you know, the simple fact of the matter is that right now in the United States, by and large, we have minority rule. Democrats in the U.S. Senate represent 41 million more Americans than do the Republicans. Democrats in the House of Representatives represent about 9 million more Americans than do Republicans in the House of Representatives. The last time a Democrat was initially elected to President of the United States with a majority of the popular vote was 1988. All those things tell you how much Americans hate Republican policies. And yet, Republicans have gamed the system by building out mostly right-wing talk radio infrastructure in red states to keep them red and turn them red, you know, back in the day, back in the 80s and 90s. And gerrymandering, and then using the Electoral College. If we were a true majority rule country, we never would have had President George W. Bush, and we never would have had President Donald Trump, because George W. Bush lost the popular vote by a half a million, and Donald Trump lost the first election, 2016, by 3 million, the second one by 7 million. So,
I get all that. I get all that. You know, I listen to your show every day. And
am I missing here?
I understand. Well, I mean, how do you be fair to, you know, the minority? Because you don't want, you know, I mean, you could argue, okay, majority rule, you could call it mob rule, which is a little hyperbolic. And certainly minority rule is the lesser of, is less good than majority rule. But I don't think that the minority should be completely disregarded.
The one exception, Maverick, to majority rule is when the majority's desires infringe on the rights of the minorities. You know, and the example of that, for example, was, you know, segregated schooling, you know, or segregated lunch counters. I mean, you know, when majority desires, and this was, you know, state by state majority, but, you know, when majority desires trample the rights of minorities, whether it's women in Texas or whether it was black people in Georgia in 1967, then the majority has the right to use authority and power to overrule the desires of the minority. The minority has the right to overrule the desires of the majority because they're damaging people's rights. But otherwise, hey, in a democracy, if you lose, tough luck. You know, like you said, you know, if the majority want to go right and you want to go left, okay, you go right with them and you know, get over it. That's the bottom line.
Yeah, I guess I guess we're on the same page, and I probably need to come to the acceptance that this is a complex solution that doesn't have a simple answer.
Well, the way that some societies do this is by consensus. This is how the United Nations is run. This is how most Native American tribes are run, and how the old Northwest Territories of Canada were run. You have to have 100% agreement, and then everybody is represented. But that's awful tough. Maverick, I got to run.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
For the Tom Hartman Book Club today, we're reading from Monica L. Smith's book, Cities, the First 6,000 Years. This is from Chapter 1, titled Why Cities. As an archaeologist, my favorite place in Rome is not the Colosseum or the Forum. It's the ancient trash dump of Monte Testaccio. Right in the middle of the city, it's a giant mound of broken pottery where the ancient Romans threw away the containers used to ship wine and olive oil all over the Mediterranean. Each of those vessels was about half the height of a person and made of coarse clay that would have roughed up a stevedore's hands. Their odd shape of two handles and a pointy base made them good for packing into a ship's hold or standing upright on a sandy shoreline, but very inconvenient for anything else. After a cargo of them arrived at its destination on the hustling shores of the Tiber, at the very heart of the Roman world, a few were reused and a few were recycled. Over the centuries, the pile of discards grew, with the result that one of the famous hills of Rome is actually not a hill at all, but of human construction, a landfill, essentially. Today, Monte Testaccio is topped by trendy nightclubs and has been endlessly mined for construction, but there are still the remains of 25 million ancient containers poking up from the vegetation of the hillside. Now consider a very different metropolis. My favorite part of Tokyo? The backside of the Tsukiji fish market, that part that tourists don't visit. Tsukiji is enormous, and the passageways are crowded with plastic buckets and barrels, teeming with every kind of creature that you can imagine from the briny deep. Crabs attempt to crawl their way out of baskets, little fish are piled up in ice buckets, and great slabs of tuna glisten under the Klieg lights. The market is open to everyone, with chefs and restaurant owners jostling with homemakers for a clearer view of the day's catch. It's a world without friendly chit-chat, punctuated by the dangerous darting movements of souped-up forklifts that dodge their way in and out of the buildings and heap up their discards out back. Behind the market is an enormous dump of plastic foam shipping boxes used to transport the globally sourced tuna, squid, and shrimp from each morning's auctions. The pile of containers is taller than a two-story building, and so large that it is continually cleared by bulldozer. Some of the cartons are trampled and broken in the process, with bits and pieces that spill further into the passageway. In between the endless runs of machinery, merchants and their helpers come to pick through the heaps of box fragments, sorting through the pile to find ones that aren't too broken. They carry them off to repack with fish or whatever else they're selling. Ancient Rome and modern Tokyo are literally a world apart, but if we stand back and look at them as cities, they have identical characteristics. In addition to markets and trash, there are multi-story buildings, long streets, sewer pipes, water mains, public squares, and a downtown zone of financial institutions and government offices. There are 1,000 varieties of sounds and smells competing with the weather and daylight that frame the skyline in the built environment. There are crowds of people. Rich, poor, young, old, female, gay, straight, trans, able, disabled, employed, students, jobless, residents, and visitors. Production and consumption opportunities are scaled up in cities to provide not only more things, but also more things per person, a completely ironic abundance given that urban residences tend to be much smaller than their rural counterparts. In the midst of so much abundance, the only solution is to cycle through possessions faster, turning everything into trash. It's the act of discard that provides the most telling evidence of urban activity, whether it's a broken potsherd from 2,000 years ago or a fragment of a plastic crate that was shattered this morning. Once you start to look for the concentrated detritus of your own urban life, it's everywhere. In the trash cans that bear the proud logo of the downtown business improvement district, in the dumpster parked outside a building that signals the renovation taking place inside, in the garbage truck that obstructs your commute, in the legions of sanitation workers employed to sweep the streets and subways and haul out the accumulations of discards. Trash has a familiar rhythm and concentration. Holidays bring a hangover of extra full trash bins. Parades and festivals and summer weekends in the park are witnessed through their aftermath of overflowing trash containers. Whether directly or by proxy, an urban obsession with trash is everywhere, and once you start to look, you won't be able to stop seeing it. Congratulations, you're an archaeologist. Move your gaze upward or to the side, you might notice it's not just trash that silently tells the story of urban life. Your own metropolis, even if it's new, has many traces that reveal its history before you moved through its streets. Maybe it's a bolt hole in the sidewalk where a telephone booth used to stand, or an out-of-use railroad track now embedded in the asphalt of the city's street. Maybe it's a building that has been updated once or twice, resulting in the pastiche of a Victorian facade with mirrored glass windows, or a modernist concrete structure fronted by flowers and cheerful painted windowsills. And maybe it's a newly cut ditch in the street where you can see the layered pavements of prior years right up to the present. Buildings and streets and parks serve as a living map of variable time, a collection of structures that all exist simultaneously, whether they were constructed a millennium ago, in your grandparents' time, or just last week. Your growing archaeological insights serve you well when looking not only at modern cities, but also at the ancient cities that are found by the hundreds on nearly every continent. Such famous ones such as Rome to not so famous ones with romantic names like Tikal, Telbrock, and Expion. The book Cities, the First 6,000 Years by Monica L. Smith.
And welcome back. Dee in Seattle. Hey, Dee, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I'm calling about the global emergency of monkeypox. I just happened to tune in to Amy Goodman. She was talking about how people are calling it instead orthopox based on reservoir rodents. Like, I immediately know what that is. I was just wondering if you know if there's any differences, like in the duration of symptoms or hospitalization, and did they know the kind of smallpox, monkeypox was the go-to vaccine for this? And is it still a global emergency? I mean, no one's explaining anything.
Yeah, to the best of my knowledge, it is still a global emergency. It is still spreading in the United States now. There is monkeypox vaccine available. There has been an effort for some time to change the name from monkeypox to something else. Because there was a concern that monkeypox sounded racist. As in most monkeys come from Africa and Asia, I get it and I don't get it, right? It's like, you know.
But I mean, is it like the hospitalization and the duration of symptoms, is there any kind of big difference?
I don't think changing the name of a virus changes how it affects people, Dee.
Yeah, because the only thing I saw was, like, when I see pictures of African monkeypox, it's like white boils. When I see recent pictures, America, it's red lesions. It doesn't look the same in some way.
Yeah. I am not an expert on this at all, even remotely, so I just don't know the answer to your questions, Dee. I'm sorry. But thank you for calling.
Go ahead. Thanks so much.
Okay. Yeah, if you find out anything, call and let me know. I'll let you do the deep dive on this. Bob in Asheville, North Carolina. Hey, Bob, is the storm heading your way now?
I'm in western North Carolina. We may miss a lot, but we could have some serious flooding.
Yeah.
So we're just crossing our fingers right now.
I wish you well. There's a lot of people in a lot of pain right now. It's just incredible, just unbelievable. It's like, we all need to double down on helping and sending good vibes or prayers or whatever.
Right. There's much more to come.
Yeah.
Tom, what I want to talk about is I'm a retired state college faculty member, and if I were to be convicted of stealing thousands of student records, my retirement would be ended immediately. And I think if we can get a conviction for Trump for espionage or any of the other many things he's done against our country, why could we not end his retirement and pension?
Yeah, he's making $400,000 a year just as a former president, if my recollection is correct. Not to mention Secret Service and health care and everything else.
Right. And he didn't accept it while he was working, right? He gave all his
salary
away.
Well, nobody really knows. He said he gave it to charity, but nobody really knows.
Yeah. I'm saying that extremely sarcastically.
Yeah.
But Melania could receive that for the next 40 years plus.
Yeah.
If he were to die. And I don't understand why our taxpayers would pay a traitorous, treasonous.
Well, first you have to prove that he's traitorous and treasonous. And that's where the United States Senate dropped the ball badly when they didn't convict him of on the impeachment.
Well, if we're not going to lock him up because of turmoil, we could at least end his retirement and benefits.
I'm with you.
As a penalty.
I'm absolutely with you. I don't think it's going to happen until or unless he's convicted of something that involves, you know, as a part of the penalty, the inability to run for political office, like sedition. And I would love to see him.
We can hope.
Yeah, I would love to see him convicted of sedition. Bob, thank you for the call. And I wish you the very best with the storm coming. Good thing that you're away from the coast. This is a tough one, but this is also just the beginning. Global warming is here. We'll be back.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Batten down the hatches. There's a worldwide recession coming. This is amazing. Consumer prices in the 19-country Eurozone rose a record 10% in September from a year earlier. It was only 9.1% in August. Now, most of this is being driven by the war in Ukraine. The price of energy is up 40.8% over a year ago, and that's because of the Russian embargo, although food, alcohol, and tobacco prices have jumped 11%. Meanwhile, here in the United States, and this is why I said there's a worldwide recession coming, here in the United States, the Fed's one of the favorite gauges that they use, it's an official one, but it's not like the official, you know, it's not like GDP or something like that. It's called the Personal Consumption Expenditures Index, PCE. And it was flat in July, but August, not so much. Including gas and energy, headline PCE increased 0.3% in August compared with a decline of 0.1% in July. This is from Jeff Cox, an economic and financial analyst who's posting this over on Twitter. He notes that the Fed generally favors PCE as the broadest indicators of where prices are heading. MarketWatch is also noting annualized PCE inflation rises to 6.4% in August from the prior month's 6.2%. In other words, inflation is actually picking up in the United States, not slowing down. Now, this does not factor in the Fed's latest rate hike. And now we have mortgage interest rates above 7% in the United States for the first time, frankly, I think since the 80s. First time in a long time, anyway. And that is cooling off the housing market like there's no tomorrow. These independent private mortgage lenders are just bailing out like crazy, you know, laying people off and shutting down operations and some of them going bankrupt. I told you the story yesterday of a friend of mine who had a loan approved, you know, weeks ago, and then they came back and said, well, we can't write the check yet because all of our underwriters were fired or laid off. So, you know, where does this go? I don't know, but I do know that I'm, you know, and again, don't ever take investment advice from me. I'm terrible. But nonetheless, I am out of everything and, you know, all in with savings accounts and CDs and stuff like that, which I know I realize I'm losing money, but it's better than being in the market right now. And the bond market has collapsed, too. And the only currency that is getting stronger is the U.S. dollar. Jeremiah in Coalport, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jeremiah. Thanks for watching or listening on the Tom Hartman app. What's up?
Hey, Tom. So on Monday, I lived next to my parents, and both my yard signs, one for Fetterman, one for Shapiro, were stolen. And also my parents had one of their Fetterman signs stolen. Mm-hmm. I found one of the Fetterman signs up the road. But I was just wondering, you know, what are your thoughts about what I can do with it? Because I've thought about calling the police, but, you know, best case scenario, they come, take my statement, nothing happens. Worst case scenario, they come, take my statement and say, oh, yeah, we noticed your grass isn't mowed as well, so we're going to issue you a citation.
I doubt they'll even take the, we contacted the Portland police with video of somebody trying to break into our house and they weren't interested. My daughter had a car stolen from her and, you know, they didn't want to hear about that either. There are some people doing some inventive things. You know, they're covering the edges of the signs with the kind of grease that you just can't wash off easily. They're hooking them up to electric fence chargers. somebody will get a shock if they grab it.
My one neighbor said that he puts dog feces on his.
Yeah, there's another option. I mean, you know, there are things that you can do that might discourage, vandals. But, you know, the vandals will just start wearing gloves. This is low-level kind of political guerrilla warfare that has been going on probably forever in America. And I would just, you know, whenever you pick up a sign, pick up three.
Yeah.
Put them out again. The other thing you might want to do is put a security camera, you know, if you've got any security cameras in your home, point one of them at the sign and see if you can, you know, catch who did it. And put the camera in such a way that if the person's driving up in a car, which is what they typically do, you can catch the license plate. And then you'd have more of a charge for vandalism. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Good luck. Good luck, Jeremiah. Sorry to hear about it. Tony in Long Island, New York. Hey, Tony, thanks for watching us on Free Speech. What's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you doing? I got cut off before. I apologize for that. Okay. This is in reference to, you were speaking before about buying made in America.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't disagree with your sentiment, but I've been in the manufacturing industry for over 40 years, and I've seen the unfortunate decline. I mean, before COVID, there was approximately 3.9 million skilled labor jobs that were available that nobody was actually taking. Since COVID has hit, now the amount of skilled labor jobs available are up to 5.3 million.
Yep.
On top of that, unfortunately, there are no school. They're in school, which is where children should be taught this, or at least be exposed to CNC machining, things
right,
like
that. Right, we used to have shop class. We need to bring all that stuff back, Tony.
Right. Well, the problem is that they have wood shop, but they don't have CNC machining in any of these classes. And if you don't catch them by 10th grade, you're never going to have this.
Well, a lot of unions run really comprehensive training programs, you know.
Yeah, the problem is that unions for machinists are very small, very exclusive, and there's not a large sector of machinists.
Tony, real quick, do you have a solution?
My solution is that we should work directly with the manufacturers of the machines.
There you go. Okay, Tony, thank you for that.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Our book today in the Tom Hartman Book Club is Tell the Bosses We're Coming by Sean Richman. The subtitle, A New Action Plan for Workers in the 21st Century. This is from the first chapter, chapter one, titled The System is a Trap. Why can't unions grow? In an age of rampant inequality, at a time of increasing social protest, including a notable uptick in workers' strikes, and when a majority of workers say they want to be union members, why does union density continue to decline? The reason is we have structural problems, lots of them, one piled atop the other. The system of labor relations that came out of the New Deal and matured in the post-Second World War era has evolved into a complex and insidious trap. This trap prevents workers who want to join unions from legally doing so. It legally restricts workers' rights to protest our routine use and abuse by rich and powerful corporations. It confines unions to sectors of the economy that are not growing. It gives bosses veto power over whether a new union can even be formed in a workplace. It sharply narrows the scope of issues that unions can even put on the bargaining table. The combination of exclusive union representation, mandatory agency fees, no-strike clauses, and so-called management rights are the foundations of our peculiar union shop. No other country structures its labor relations systems quite like this. Our labor system didn't always look like this. It developed through a series of historical accidents. It has been made unworkable by a dogged anti-union legal campaign run by the vast right-wing conspiracy of think tanks, industry lobbyists, and bloodthirsty billionaires. The system has become a trap. Part of that trap, however, is in our own heads. Too many union activists and allies take for granted what a union is, how it should be organized, and what collective bargaining looks like.
There's an analogy that makes the rounds in Cornell University's labor extension program. It involves a man sharing his grandma's pot roast recipe with a friend. First step of the recipe calls for cutting the ends off the raw rump, which prompts the friend to ask, "Really? Does that, like, make the roast more tender, or what?" The man sharing the recipe, who had never questioned why it calls for the ends to be cut off, calls his mom to ask why the recipe calls for the ends of the rump roast to be cut off. She confesses that she never thought about it either, and suggests that her older sister might know. So the man proceeds to call his aunt, who is similarly thrown off by the simple question. She had never questioned why the recipe called for this little bit of home butchery. All she knows is that the dish she made when following the recipe tasted good. It tasted familiar. And so on and so forth, as this man calls through family historians and home cooks until he finally visits his grandma at the nursing home. And she dismissively explains, "Oh, it's because the grocer only sold rump roasts that were too big for our roast pan." Oops. This is the most devastatingly on-the-nose analogy for how unions engage in long-term strategy. We hope and assume that sometime in the past, someone smarter than we are considered all the possible options and settled what we're currently doing as the best possible choice. We want there to be more unions and assume that means more unions that are just like our current unions. And so we get excited for silver bullet solutions like foregoing NLRB elections in favor of majority sign-up or card check certifications, or overturning right to work that seem like they would help unions grow. Even when we argue among ourselves about how unions need to change to win more, we just nibble around the edges of what that problem is. More robust union organizing departments running comprehensive organizing campaigns would be good and valuable, just as more face-to-face organizing conversations in existing union shops and networks of trained workplace leaders would revitalize many unions. But these won't grow the labor union in any movement in any appreciable way because they're still trapped in a rotten anti-labor, anti-union system. How can I so casually and confidently assert that more organizing won't significantly add to the ranks of union membership? Because it hasn't. We are nearly a quarter century into what I call the organize or die push by unions to significantly increase the amount of money and energy they spend on new union organizing. Of course, when it comes to organizing, many unions talk the talk but fail to walk the walk. I'll discuss some of those reasons why in Chapter 4. However, there are unions that have developed and actually maintained fidelity to organizing model strategies, putting hundreds of organizers in the field and successfully organizing thousands of bargaining units and new union members. These unions have survived, but they have not thrived. They have not greatly increased their density or their power. And the millions of workers who want to be union members remain outside the labor movement's ranks. When most of us speak of the organizing model, we are talking about methods of organizing within our broken system that may vary from each other slightly, but are all informed by the research of Dr. Kate Bronfenbrenner at Cornell. Dr. Bronfenbrenner identified 10 comprehensive organizing tactics from her own previous organizing experience. These include, number one, adequate and appropriate staff and financial resources. This means not just putting enough staff organizers on the ground, she recommends a ratio of one staffer for every 100 workers, but also research and communications support to take out ads, hold rallies, get buttons and t-shirts for the activists. The book is Tell the Bosses We're Coming by Sean Richmond. We'll be back with more of the news and more of my thoughts and yours in this kind of national town hall meeting we have here every day on the Tom Hartman program. And in the meantime, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. Never was intended to be. It requires you. So get out there, get active, tag. You're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.